This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757. Please send emails to talk@talklouisiana.org. Producing Robin Dow, and our leadoff guest is the legendary coach, Nolan Richardson. He is a person who is a pioneer, and his record is such that few, if any, people have accomplished what he has. He won the NCAA championship 30 years ago this season with the Arkansas Razorbacks, went to the Final Four three times, and finished runner-up in 95, but in 94, his Hogs were the champs, but also an NIT championship at Tulsa and a junior college national championship as well. So he is the only coach to win all three championships. He's been retired for a few years, but in his 22 seasons coaching in Division I, his teams won 35 postseason games. Nolan Richardson is the guest, and again, your number is 877-217-5757. Good morning, Coach.
Good morning, Jim. How are you this morning?
I'm doing well, and you were in lovely Fayetteville, Arkansas. 155-acre farm, right?
You're close. A little under, about 151. it's quite a few acres.
You're a kid from El Paso, Texas, and you go to Fayetteville, Arkansas. And you did so in 1985 when you were 43 years old, and you fell in love with the place. And even though the great triumphs you had there were in some ways overshadowed by the way you never left Arkansas. And some people say, why? You could have lived anywhere you wanted.
I could have, but I had fell in love long before with Arkansas, the Fayetteville area, the northwest Arkansas. People were very, very kind to me. The fans were very, very, very kind to me, my family. And of course, I wasn't one of those guys was going to be jumping around from job to job hunting. Arkansas was the job that probably I would want. And to finish it, I would have wanted to probably finish that Arkansas. And there was no reason for me to leave it. And so, the more I stayed, the more I enjoyed it, and the more I loved it.
But most coaches in retirement aren't out working with cattle and cleaning up barns, but you do it every day, don't you?
Well, I used to. I can't get around like I used to. I had a lot of fun of raising horses. I had horses and pigs and goats. You name it, I had those kind of animals. Me and the wife were very, very into animal loving. And so you can come home to your animals and it didn't matter if you won or lost, they're the same. So I enjoyed that, being able to just go out and work on the farm type situation where there's chickens. I grew up as a city kid, but enjoyed the country life.
Obviously. But you lost your mom when you were 3 years old, and to come back from that and to accomplish what you have in life is remarkable. But how was your youth? It was not what some would say an idyllic childhood, was it?
Not really. Any time I think about my childhood, I think about my grandmother, old mama. Old mama was, our mom left us at three. I had a sister that was 6-7 months old. My oldest sister was probably about five. And then we lived in the Los Angeles area. She came and got us. We were her son's kids. And that old lady became our mother, our father, our grandparent. She was everybody. And so she was my greatest hero. And growing up she's a very religious home, really set the tone for how I should behave and what my priorities were. And I give that credit to old mama all the time that I speak, that I had a hero at home, and it was my grandmother.
And your father was largely absent?
Most of the time, Jim. My dad had tried the professional fighting route and spent time trying to box, and between drinking and boxing, you know, he didn't last very long either. I think at the age of 39 going to 40, he passed away. So we as little kids didn't see him that much, but that was kind of the life that we had to deal with. And like I said again, my old granny steps up and do everything that needs to be done for her grandkids.
Nolan Richardson is our guest, and he is one of a kind, and didn't have the cookie-cutter upbringing, but he got a good education, and his athletic prowess certainly helped. Ended up at Texas Western, then later to become UTEP, and of course, a few years after he left, Don Haskins and Texas Western won the national championship, beating Kentucky. But you played for a legendary coach in his formative stage, and I'm sure that set the stage for you for all the future accomplishments.
Absolutely. Coach Haskins was tremendous. He's ahead of his time, being able to do what he did, opening the doors to give the African-American kid an opportunity to really play. I remember there was time that being in college, and my first year at the UTEP, I was the only African-American on the basketball team. We were the first team to get the team to the NCAA tournament. And then 2 years later, they won it all. So Coach Haskins, there's no question about pioneer or trailblazer. He opened doors that others dared to try to open. The only other guy that I could think of was Brown. Dale Brown.
yeah, he's your buddy. And Coach Brown's a competitive guy. And, of course, you played him after his great years, and you had great teams, and you won most of the time. But he doesn't hold that against you. He loves Nolan Richardson.
Well, the feeling is mutual. I think the world of Dale is one of the smarter, outgoing basketball coaches that are young coaches I was coming up could kind of copy his style or his ways and the things that he tried to do and accomplish. So He is by far one of my guys that I admire.
A listener asks, 40 minutes of hell. That's what they termed your strategy, and that's exactly what it was, just an unrelenting press on the opposition. How did that come about?
Well, I was very fortunate to come up in a city that pressing defense of the high school. I spent 10 years on the high school campus coaching basketball. And then up the road was a man by the name, at Hobbs, New Mexico. He was the head basketball coach that ran a 2-2-1 press. And it was just whipped everybody in El Paso. And some of the schools in El Paso ran presses. And I started toward the end of my high school career running a press and having trying to get more shots or trying to get cheaper baskets. That was the only way to go. I was at a school that had a few kids that were 6 feet tall. All my guys were 5'8", 5'7". So we went to the press type defense in order to give us a chance to get some cheap baskets.
877-217-5757 for Coach Nolan Richardson. And we will go to the phone lines in a moment. But what a life he has led. And he had the great triumphs at the University of Arkansas. And then he, of course, at the end had his collision with the legendary athletic director and former football coach, John Franklin Broyles. You two were worthy adversaries, weren't you?
There was a great, to me, as I took the job at the University of Arkansas, one of my greatest, the guys I admired was Frank Broyles, because of being in El Paso, most of our coaches came. You know, we had one of the coaches that played for Coach Broyles that I was with at the high school for many years, and I'd heard so much of him. And so when I was able to take the job here, it was a plus. It ended up a plus because I think he opened some doors that would have opened had he not made the decision to hire me.
But at the end, of course, you basically challenged him to fire you and pay you what you were owed, and he did it. And some were surprised he did. And then he, at the same time, was defending Houston Nutt, a football coach with, of course, much less success than you. And it got on your last nerve at the time, didn't it?
It did. There was no question that I worked extremely hard, and I never really felt that I would ever be working on the same level, playing field. The playing field was not level for me.
We're going to take a 89.3-second break and return with the coach, Nolan Richardson. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Nolan Richardson is the guest, the legendary coach at the University of Arkansas, and 30 years ago, this October, as next month, he was assembling a team that would win the national championship, and that is hard to do in collegiate basketball. He went to the Final Four three times with the Razorbacks. He's the only coach to win the national title for the University of Arkansas, and he almost won it the next year against UCLA, but lost in the championship game in 1995. And as mentioned, won in a remarkable 35 postseason games in 22 years at the major college level. That is almost unheard of. 35 wins in 22 seasons, and his team's made the postseason 20 times. But a legacy beyond the accomplishments on the court for Coach Richardson. And listener, before we go to the phone lines, ask Coach, what do you make of the new environment with NIL, with the transfer portal? How has that changed the environment?
Big time change. I'm looking at a professional basketball program now. I think the ones who got the most money don't get the best players. I mean, with the rules being the way they are today, you don't have to worry about assembling a team from a freshman standpoint. You go out and buy you a couple of very 2 or 3, 25, 26-year-old guys and put them on the floor, and you got a chance to win a national championship. That's why I think there won't be probably as much dominance of the lower of basketball teams winning. It's changed drastically because from one year to the next, you've got probably a new team, new players. They're able to transfer from you. You might have almost won a national championship next year. Those two or three guys that helped you do that are transferring because they're not getting enough playing time. Yeah. It's too wide open.
Certainly not the connection to universities the way there used to be when players would play 4, sometimes 5 years, and it happens on occasion, but it is rare. And Nolan Richardson has seen the world evolve, and you mentioned when you were at UTEP, then Texas Western, it's hard to believe you were the only black guy on the team at first, but that changed. And then ultimately across the country. Maybe because of what happened with Don Haskins beating Adolph Rupp, the world changed. But still, particularly as a coach, how much racism, if you will, did you experience in your career?
Quite a bit. Growing up in an area that was, well, the whole state of Texas was segregated. We went to a small black school all the way from the first to the eighth grade. And in 1955, when the integration took place, we really noticed that some of the black kids who had gone to the black schools were transferring to the school that was, you know, different races or were attending, except for African American. I remember playing baseball. I was really loved the game. And we won district. We had to go to Abilene or Odessa I couldn't stay with the team. I had to stay in a hotel. I mean, they stayed in the hotel, and I stayed across the tracks with a little black family, and they picked me up to go to the game and then dropped me back off there for the next day for the next game. So I experienced that several times. I experienced at college being one of the only blacks on the team. We played in Centenary. There was a tournament there. My coach called me in and said I couldn't make the trip because they don't allow blacks on their court.
In Shreveport, Louisiana.
So they left me at home. Mm. I mean, when you start thinking about all the things, when you're 10 years old and you go to the swimming pool and you can't get in because you're black. I mean, it goes on and on and on. And that's why I my grandmother harped that in us a bit. Jackie, if it wasn't for Jackie Robinson, we would still not be playing baseball if we hadn't found someone to lead the way a little bit. And she was always talking about there's gravel on the road. in order for your kids to be successful, you got to help smooth the gravels out so they can walk a little bit better. That's how she explained it to me. So, yes, I could go on all day and all night about the injustice and the unfairness officiating the game. The officials they may say they were not biased, but I experienced they were. And so, and I know that other coaches would say the same thing. But when you're playing games in Texas and junior college and you're the only black coach in the whole system, there's maybe 50 junior colleges and you're the only one, and you're playing against the guy that's next to buddy is one of the officials, or his brother's the official. You got some problems there. And so there's many ways in which we can announce racism has played a very important part. It always have and probably always will.
We're visiting with Nolan Richardson, member of the National Collegiate Basketball Hall of Fame and the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame. Please be concise. John in Mid-City. John, you're on with Coach Richardson.
Jim, correct me if I'm wrong, but when Coach Richardson won the national championship at Arkansas, it was bad. Dale Brown that defeated him two times during the course of that season.
I don't think that's correct, but keep going.
Okay, can you check it out?
I don't think that's correct, no.
Okay, all right. Well, I apologize for that. Coach, further talk about the influence that Texas Western team had on modern basketball, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Did that change the world when Don Haskins, with his upstarts from Texas Western, beat Adolph Rupp and Pat Riley and Louis Dampier and the Kentucky Monolith in 1966?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was okay to play. I remember Coach Haskins showing me some of the dreadful mail that came in, how the players were called apes, guys that had no intelligence playing and representing a university that has no. I mean, it was pretty much garbage, and it was sad because I don't think they could have enjoyed the winning a national championship like the average kid would enjoy. He had something to prove by starting all five African Americans on that team. I was ahead of those guys, so I knew them pretty well. And they were a little bit different. They were kids from New York, Detroit. Most of the players were off of the East Coast. And they lived a little bit different freedom type life than we did in the South. And so Coach Haskins doing what he did made it simple to introduce that you can start five blacks or three or four or whatever. It's all about whether you want to win or lose. You play your best players, and they were the best players. And he was he was one of those guys that said, "Hey, these are my five best. This is what I'm playing with." and nothing, you know, to me is winning is what it's all about. And that's what he did. He didn't he didn't look at the black kid and say, "Hey, you're black, so you need to beat the white guy." And I don't think that had nothing to do with it. You had a team that was playing against his team. He wanted to win. And who? How do you win? You win by playing your best players.
We're hearing the voice of Coach Nolan Richardson, and I have a few inquiries from listeners. We won't keep the coach much longer, but we will take a short pause and come back after the break. And, of course, we'll also remember the late, great folk singer Jim Croce, who died on this date, 1973, September 20th, flying out of Natchitoches, Louisiana, after a concert at Northwestern State. What a mark he left on the music world in just a couple of years on the scene. 877-217-5757. Back with Coach Richardson after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us. The remarkable Robin Dow, producing today with the equally able assistance of Renee Martin. And Nolan Richardson is with us for just a few more moments, the legendary coach who led the Arkansas Razorbacks to the promised land 30 seasons ago. Do you keep in touch with those guys, Coach? Corliss Williamson and Todd Day and the big stars on your team at that time?
I talk to them, you know, quite frequently. Some of them more than I need to. that's the great part of being a basketball coach.
You're like a father. You're like a father to them, aren't you?
Absolutely. You know, they still, those guys, I mean, it's so many of them. The sad part, Jim, is when one of them leaves us and no longer with us anymore on this earth, that is the hardest thing to take. You know, you can, it just bothers me and bleeds me so much when one of my guys are no longer with us, you know. But of course, keeping tabs on me, I have guys that keep tabs on me pretty regularly. Mm-hmm.
Well, I remember Todd Day got in a fight with Maurice Williamson at an LSU game. And after the game, when you were asked about what happened, you said, "There's no way Todd was going to let that little man push him around." And he goes, "You know, Todd's a Capricorn."
Yeah, I knew all my guys' signs.
Did you? You recruited some on zodiac signs?
Yes, I did. I could say, "Hey, I was born in December, Capricorn. Should I know that when you push me in the corner, I'm fighting all the way." And if it goes that route, that's what happens. So, you know, I think all signs are basically do that, but there are some signs to me that are quicker to do something than the other signs that I used to recruit. And I paid close attention to when they were born.
Yeah, you liked Capricorns.
Well, I guess because I was one.
Yeah, I know, as am I, but so was Muhammad Ali, so was Joe Frazier and George Foreman.
There you go. I wanted you to say that, not me.
Yeah, but so was Frank Broyles. And so
right. Frank's birthday is one day before mine.
I know. But it's amazing how you can collide with a person and then after they pass away, as Broyles has, I guess in some ways the disagreements you had are immense, but at some point it's like life is short.
You know, he had a job to do, and you got to respect that as time goes. His job was to make sure that his basketball, football, baseball, and track programs, you know, took the front seat. And I thought Coach Broyles did a tremendous job in coming to Arkansas and getting the fans all to rally around one university. I don't care where you live. Everybody's a Razorback. It's amazing. And so, you know, you got to have your hats off to a guy that says, "Okay, we're going to open the door." What's the reason has nothing to do with it, to hire Nolan Richardson and to hire a guy that has a sick daughter that hardly ever comes up about how I came to Arkansas with a girl that had leukemia. And lost my baby, and it was 2 years into a season. And then understanding that no one, your daughter doesn't matter unless you win basketball games. That I think that's the part that that hurt me the most, that I was losing a girl, not so much losing a game. And to this day, I think it's because of her I decided to take the job at the University of Arkansas, and I've stayed ever since.
That's 36 years ago that you lost your baby daughter, and I know, I can tell, it's as though it were right now. It still stings, doesn't it?
It's right there, man. Again, as I said over and over, they asked me, how did I feel? That's the first thing I looked up into the heavens and said, thank you, Lord. We got her one, finally. And she brought me here, mm-hmm. so she helped me finish this. Gave me the energy and the effort and the hate and the anger and the whatever else I needed to have to do a job that we came here to do.
Finally, Manuel on corporate says, your wardrobe has to be mentioned before we part company. You were a trailblazer in that area, too. I love the way you looked on the court. You certainly made an impression, Coach.
Well, I love dressing, and I love boots. I grew up in Tony Lama land, the guy in high school who has become the big boot maker of the world kind of for a while, especially in our area. So it was nothing for me to just try to look my best at every game that we played. And I have to give that credit to my wife, who basically picked out the clothes I would wear before each game.
Well, you did it well, and I think the women's basketball coach at LSU took some cues from you. Sometimes the way you dress stimulates attention, and that's what it's all about. You have to put on a show.
That's exactly how it is. That's the same thing that happened at the University of Tulsa when I started wearing the polka dot shirts. They weren't cool when I started. But by the time you couldn't buy a polka dot shirt, it was not available anymore anywhere.
Well, Coach, you've inspired many of us for years. I'm glad you're still in the game, and you're a great man. Thank you for being with us.
Jim, I appreciate you. Thanks so much for having me.
It's my honor. Thank you, Coach Richardson. See you soon.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. And we're joined now by a couple of gentlemen from the music world, John Word, as we know, and Ted Lewis, who for many years, of course, has written about sports, but he wrote a remarkable piece in The Advocate about the death of Jim Croce 50 years ago today. The great singer was killed in Natchitoches, Louisiana. He was only 30 years old, just 30 years old, and he had only been on the scene for a couple of years, and his collection of songs, I think, ranks with many of whom have been around for a generation. To give you an idea, he had two number ones. Two. That's two more than Bruce Springsteen, one more than Bob Seger, and he did it in just a couple of years. And one of those that did not make number one, but was his first song, I think Robin Dow has pulled up, the appropriately titled first album from Jim Croce with the single You Don't Mess Around With Jim. I think you got it. It's certainly a signature song for the man from the Philadelphia area who died on this date, September 20th, 1973, flying out of Northwestern State University. Here we go.
Uptown got its hustlers. The Bowery got its bums. 42nd Street got Big Jim, a walker, he a bull shooting son of a gun. Yeah, he big and dumb as a man can come, but he's stronger than a country horse. And when the bad folks all get together at night, you know they all call Big Jim boss, just because. And they say you don't tug on Superman's cape, you don't spit into the wind, you don't pull a mask off that old Lone Ranger, and you don't mess around with Jim.
There we go. The distinctive sound of Jim Croce, and what a loss it was. And we'll start with Ted Lewis, who, as I said, wrote the piece for The Advocate and interviewed Jim's son, A.J. Croce. But Ted, you and I and John Word are of an age. We remember Jim Croce when he was alive. He was a force of nature, and what a great loss this was five decades ago.
It sure was. I was a fan back then. I just started working in Monroe, and I was a fan. I really liked the song Operator. It hit home to me one time, but everybody loved Bad Bad Lee Ward Brown, too, and so many good songs, and songs like Time in a Bottle and Stay With You over the years. I talked to Rodney Harrington, who was an entertainer up in Natchitoches and an attorney, and he said Jim had just started scratching the surface of his abilities. And I think that that's what hits home to you when you lose somebody at age 30 like he was.
Well, like Lynyrd Skynyrd, the band that lost its lead singer Ronnie Van Zant in 1977, 2 years later on a flight to Baton Rouge, the body of work, when you think about the fact that these were a group in one case and a single artist in another, they weren't around that long, but we still hear the songs, and they have held up well over time. They would be hits today. But Jim Croce was a songwriter. He wrote his material. And at this point in his career, it was really taking off, and he was making what some would say would be a tour that was beneath his fame at that time, and going to small schools, and Northwestern being one of them. He only did a 42-minute concert, as you know, Ted. It wasn't a particularly memorable concert, and he was in and out and on his way to another university, but it didn't turn out well. But you actually have talked with people who were there. What do they remember about his last performance?
Just what you said. It was sort of low-key. The crowd, Northwest, back in those days, there was a lot of, they call it the college circuit. And I was surprised to understand, like at Northwestern, they brought in John Denver. Neil Diamond played there. Helen Reddy. ZZ Top. There were several, so it was pretty common to happen. So it wasn't like a big deal. It's the biggest thing that ever happened. And also that night was the night of the Billie Jean King and
Bobby Riggs
tennis match. And on top of that, and it didn't make my story, it was the first night of TV broadcast of Bonnie and Clyde. And if you know anything about that area, Bonnie and Clyde were killed about 50 miles from Natchitoches, so it might have been people to stay home and watch Bonnie and Clyde on TV. But it was a low key, and he was tired, and he was tired of touring. AJ said it well to me. He said,
"Okay, we're going to get what AJ said to Ted Lewis, and when we return after this." This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana as we round the final quarter hour. With Ted Lewis and John Word, we're remembering Jim Croce, the fabulous singer, 30 years old, who died on this date in 1973, flying out of Natchitoches, Louisiana. And John Word, of course, is a music critic, knows a bit about the legacy of Jim Croce as an artist. But Ted Lewis did a fine story for The Advocate and Picayune about what happened in Natchitoches 30 years ago. And basically, when the plane took off, it was a pilot who screwed up, hit a tree, down goes the plane. And it wasn't just Croce and the pilot who died. There were several people on that plane, right, Ted Lewis?
There were six people on the plane, including Jim's accompanist, Marty Mulhausen, who, if you ever watch it, one of the videos from Jim, he's sitting there by him, and he was the lead guitarist and backup and sang harmony with him. And it was also his manager, and there was a comedian who opened the show.
George Stevens,
a couple
yeah.
other guys. Mm-hmm. So there were six people on the plane, which is all that plane held, was six people. The plane was apparently pretty loaded with people and luggage and fuel. And the pilot just made an error and hit a tree, and unfortunately that was it.
But the pilot, who was an older guy, older than Croce, he was in his 50s, I believe, he'd had some heart trouble. He had missed the trip to Northwestern and actually tried to walk or run or jog the 3 miles from the hotel to the university. He was not in particularly good shape when he took off, was he?
Apparently not. It's a little, with everything, it's kind of lost in the mist of time. But there was a story that they wanted to get out of there quickly because there were drugs on the plane. And they were afraid that the Natchitoches Sheriff's Department was going to arrest them. But they had also, but in the interview that Croce did with Melanie Torbett, the student reporter before the game, there was that much I've been in sports, before the concert, he told her, says, we're leaving tonight. So it wasn't like a last second thing. Why the guy was late and all that things, like I said, are a little bit lost to history. But the FAA report was that the pilot had no drugs in his system, but they did find some stuff on the plane.
Okay. Well, you mentioned A.J. Croce, the son, who was not yet 2 years old. In fact, his dad died just a few days before A.J.'s second birthday. He, of course, has had an accomplished career, too, nothing like his father, but had to overcome a lot. The mother, Ingrid, had a boyfriend who beat him up as a kid, and he was temporarily blinded, wasn't he, and not just a few hours, it was a few years.
Right. From age 4 until he was a teenager, and I didn't ask him directly, but what I understand, he only regained sight in one eye.
But Jim Croce, his music is fantastic today. And Ted, we'll let you go. I know you're traveling, but John Word is in studio, and he's the guy who knows, he knows the lay of the land when it comes to Croce's impact on the music world. And for a guy who just had a couple of years on the scene, I don't know of anybody else who made the mark that he did. The two number ones, by the way, a listener asked, the two number ones that he had were Bad Bad Leroy Brown and Time in a Bottle, which Glenn Campbell, of all people, called the greatest song of all time.
Wow.
But, John, what about Croce as an artist?
Well, you know, one of the people that Ted quotes in his story is Calvin Gilbert, who was the former Advocate music writer, and he went off to Nashville after that. But Calvin was an NSU student who saw this concert, as Ted reveals in the story. And in the story, Calvin says, I think Jim Croce would have had a long-lasting career.
Well, so Calvin, there's any doubt.
Calvin is a good judge of such things, and you know, all of us heard those songs and were touched or moved by so many of those songs, and enjoyed the upbeat things as well, but it's one of those questions that can only be guessed at. You know, would Jim Croce have had a long career that paralleled, for instance, a contemporary like James Taylor or Jackson Brown? That was the golden age of singer-songwriters. But
I think he already had more number ones than either one of those guys, And he wrote all his stuff, too, as of course, they're songwriters as well. But a lot of artists, as we know, and my favorite singer, Frank Sinatra, he never wrote anything, but he was a great singer. But Croce not only was a remarkable performer, he rewrote what he performed.
Yes, and you mentioned Frank Sinatra. Frank Sinatra recorded Bad, Bad Leroy Brown.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, and if Sinatra's going to record your song, I don't think you get a bigger recommendation than that.
And a song like that.
Yeah.
His valet, who was with us many years ago, wrote a book about him, a guy from New Orleans. He said that Sinatra once in 1967, the valet's driving around Los Angeles, and Sinatra hears Light My Fire for about the fifth time, and he kicked in the dashboard. He just couldn't handle it anymore. But he did Bad, Bad Leroy Brown, and that would, I guess, become the signature song for Jim Croce. You said it was about a guy who served with him in the military, but if you listen closely to both Bad, Bad Leroy Brown and You Don't Mess Around With Jim, both of those guys meet their match in the end. They're not invincible, and it says something about Croce And supposedly the last words, and Ted alluded to it in his story at the concert, he said, your work is significant usually until you're about 60. He's got, I got a half a lifetime to go, as he headed out at age 30. And of course, a few minutes later, he was gone, and shows you how vulnerable we all are. But what's your favorite Croce song, John Wirt?
Well, Time in a Bottle is such a moving, you know, sensitive song. And that was the song that got to be, I think that's number one after his death.
After his death. And yeah. Some of the songs were, of course, released posthumously, and Robin Dowes pulled one up that was released one day after his death. But he started out doing, as many great artists do, he was an opening act, as Ted noted, for Woody Allen, George Carlin. He was getting $750 a night. Ultimately, he was getting $10,000 a concert. He was on his way. He was on his way to greatness, and his impact is still relevant all these years later. But when a person dies like that, I noticed a few years ago when Rolling Stone listed his greatest singers of all time, a lot of them are people who died young. We reminisce, and perhaps we glorify them beyond their reach, but in this case, I don't think so. I think he definitely was a person. What a loss. Think about what he would have done in the last 50 years.
Again, we can only speculate, but I tend to agree with Calvin that he would have had a long career, like a James Taylor or Jackson Brown. He was in that group of artists.
Same folk style, which they, I'm sure, grew up and were influenced a lot by Bob Dylan, as a lot were. And there's only one Bob Dylan who's still performing. But Dylan is fortunate that he's gotten more than 80 years, and Croce, if he were alive, would be younger than Dylan is right now. So he'd be younger than Mick Jagger and Paul McCartney. And John, as we know, some of these guys, when they get on stage like McCartney, he just goes on and on and on and never stops, and he seems ageless once he gets the adrenaline going with a crowd or urging him on.
Still going, yeah. I've seen him too. It's amazing, those three-hour shows that he does.
Yeah, in New Orleans a few years ago, he did 51 songs, and it wasn't a case where he was turning it over to somebody else, or they were doing a long guitar solo. He was going on and on and on. And Croce had that same kind of personality. For those who remember him, he was a frequent guest on a lot of these talk shows, and he was a funny, funny guy. He was on The Tonight Show more than once, and at the age of 30, he had caught the world and captured the fancy of the people, and he's gone. And we miss him. And the day after he died, on September 21st, 1973, he released this song, or it was released posthumously. It, of course, had been planned before his death, but this one has relevance because of what happened to Jim Croce. It was not a number one, but it is now remembered as one of his great works. And here's Robin Dow to close the show with the amazing Jim Croce.
Like the pine trees lining the winding road, I've got a name, I've got a name. Like the singing bird and the croaking toad, I've got a name, I've got a name. And I carry it with me like my daddy did, but I'm living the dream that he kept here. Moving me down the highway, rolling me down the highway, moving ahead so life won't pass me by. Like a north wind whistling down the sky, I've got a song, I've got a song. Like the well and the BBC.